What I desired, first of all and above all, was to create something beautiful. Beautiful meant like the late Beethoven quartets. My parents were string quartet violinists. A composer need not choose between piano sonatas or symphonies, quartets or chorales. A writer need not choose among poetry, fiction, and nonfiction. And I tested myself in all these forms. To work in more than one form is to feel a freedom that is as exhilarating as any freedom I know. Nothing can keep you out of any formal territory. You can walk where you want, go where you please. You know the way both there and back. You, your body of work.
That's Kelly Cherry reading from her book, History, Passion, Freedom, Death, and Hope, Prose About Poetry. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Kelly Cherry is the Eudora Welty Professor Emerita of English and the F.U. Bascom Professor Emerita in the Humanities from the UW-Madison. She's back in Madison for a few days as a visitor, as she now lives in Virginia, where she currently serves as Virginia's Poet Laureate. Kelly Cherry is the author of 20 books, including nonfiction essays and a memoir, short stories and novels, and poetry. Her fiction has appeared in Best American Short Stories and has won 3 Penn Syndicated Fiction Awards. And she was the first ever recipient of the Haynes Poetry Prize given by the Fellowship of Southern Writers for a body of writing. She is currently at work on a new book of poetry about J. Robert Oppenheimer, father of the atomic bomb. In this hour, Kelly Cherry joins us to explore her life and work as a writer of nonfiction, poetry, and fiction.
Welcome back to University of the Air.
Thank you very much.
I confess I'm eager to hear about Mr. Oppenheimer and how he ties into your particular brand of writing. But let's start with maybe an even stranger question, and that is there such a thing as poetry that's nonfiction, if we're going to be talking genres here?
That's a very interesting question, and that's what I'm trying to figure out right now. I'm trying to write an epic poem in, however, lyric moments, by and large, that is true and accurate, or as true and accurate as I can make it, about Robert Oppenheimer and his life and times. And just as with historical fiction, it's necessary to check on various details to make sure you've got them correct. At the same time, you can't let the details weigh the poem down. It's hard to strike the right balance, and that's what I'm working on.
And there are a lot of really interesting details with Oppenheimer,
yes,
too. We'll get
yes
to that later also.
You seem to be fascinated by this blurring of walls between the different genres. I mean, the reading that you did at the beginning is from a book where the subtitle is Prose About Poetry.
Mm-hmm.
You've written a book where it's called A Novel in Stories.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know that even things that are supposed to be autobiographical or memoir can be a sort of mm-hmm fictional creation of a self. Tell us about your actual self, you know, the autobiography, okay, and how some of that, like your
okay
reference to your parents' musicianship, does find its way into your nonfiction.
Well, as you said, I did grow up in a family of musicians. My parents were string quartet violinists, and my sister became a solo flutist and made her career in London. Music was just part of our lives. I remember crawling around on the floor among my parents' feet and the violists and the cellists, whoever they were at that time, and listening to that music. We'd lie in bed, my sister and I would lie in bed at night and hear them rehearsing in the living room. And it was the most beautiful music in the world. And I think all three of us, my sister and my brother and I, grew up with that feeling. We responded to it in different ways. And when I was about 12, I happened to write a poem. I was studying the piano pretty seriously, but I knew I was never going to be a great pianist. I don't have the hands for it. And when I was about 12, I wrote a poem. There was absolutely nothing precocious about this poem. But I made a rhyme in it. I think it was something about a woman dressed in white from head to toe, and under the moonlight she would glow. I mean, it was that dumb. And the rhyme was toe and glow. But when it happened, I suddenly thought, I'm making music. And so that was where I developed the idea that I could try to write something that would make people feel what I felt when I listened to Beethoven. And I don't know how much of that I was able at the time to put into words, but that was certainly, that became the impetus. And it's what I've been doing ever since. I think there are different kinds of music. And in fact, when we talk about the three forms, I think what really, the real difference among them is the kinds of music they make. And although it may seem, on the basis of what you've pointed to, that I'm blurring genres, I'm not. I don't think I am. I think I have a very clear, firm idea of what a story is and what a nonfiction piece is. And lots of people would disagree with me because lots of people love to blur the forms. But I like knowing that I can move among them and that each time I do that, I know where I am and what I'm trying to do.
Now, poetry inspired by Beethoven, and when you mention in the context of toe and glow, I think lyric poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the kind of thing that Beethoven inspires, or might he inspire also free verse?
He can inspire any kind of poetry as long as it's musical. And the music of a poem is the line.
The line.
Yes, and it becomes more complicated when you realize it's a line in relation to a stanza, in relation to a whole. Nevertheless, the basic unit of a poem is a line, whether it's a formal line or a free verse line. And you can't write poetry without perceiving it on a line-by-line basis.
And is there then some kind of length limit to a line of poetry as opposed to prose? I mean, you know, you think of the first, sentence of The Scarlet Letter, which is about a paragraph long.
Right.
Does that work for poetry, or does there have to be some kind of limit that's a lot shorter than that?
It doesn't work for my poetry. Of course, as I said, there are those people who want to blur genres, and a lot of people write prose poetry today. I think that's not very often successful, but there are people who are devoted to it, and they have every right to pursue that as an activity. For me, I want, when I'm writing a poem, I want to remain conscious of the line because I think that's where the music comes from, which is another way of saying I think that's where the pacing, the rhythm comes from.
What do you think about poetry in terms of carrying it around in your head? Do you have a lot of your own poetry or anyone else's that you could recite?
No. I have a terrible memory. and when I try to think of my own poetry in particular, my mind goes blank, which I'm sure is some kind of nervous reaction.
You've written so much, which is, so it's a good sign if you forget some of
the things.
Well, of
course, those rhymes were always handy for a memory hook, traditionally, poetry that came out of the oral tradition.
Yeah. I use a lot of rhyme, although not always in the expected places.
That does kind of take the curse off, doesn't it? I mean, rhymed couplets could get a little tedious after the first 600 lines or so.
Yes.
It does seem to me that the prose you write, the nonfiction you write, has a sort of poetic quality in that there's a lot of imagery and attention to sound in the sentences. Some of the books that I've got that you've written that would be considered nonfiction would include Writing the World, and also a collection, Girl in a Library, on women writers and the writing life. One thing that moved me in your autobiographical writing in Writing the World was when you talked about how, although you had this beautiful Beethoven quartet music growing up, you and your sister sometimes didn't have someone to show you how to brush your teeth. It was a kind of strange mixture of beauty and poverty rolled together. Can you talk about how you think that might have shaped you as a writer?
Well, it's... I don't know that I've ever thought about it in terms of how it shaped me as a writer. We did live either on the edge of poverty or actually in poverty for a while, but it was a rarefied sort of poverty. It was chosen. My parents wanted to play string quartets, and they did, and that meant nobody was bringing a lot of money into the house. We became kind of, the three of us, the three children, became sort of miniature hoodlums when we were living in Ithaca, New York, and then our parents finally decided to get us out of Ithaca, and we went to Virginia in time to save a couple of us anyway from going completely over the edge. So, I mean, those things shape a life. But I think the main thing was that even without any money in the house, we felt rich because we had this music. I hardly know how to talk about it. It's just so ravishing, great music is, that it made up for everything. And not long ago, I wrote a little piece, a little short called On the Care and Handling of Infants and Small Children. And in the piece, I have a little paragraph which says, you should sometimes put the infant on the floor in the middle of a string quartet. And then the infant will always, the rest of her life or his life, even in sad conditions, find that he or she is happy because she can call up that music. And that's what that music did for me. And it made us feel rich. And I know it made my sister feel the same way, and it made my brother feel the same way.
A practical question here, a really mundane question. Mm-hmm. String quartet players require four people. So
right.
Who were the other two?
Well, they varied from time to time. And the joke in the family, and a joke in many string quartet families, is who are we going to get for the cellist? Where can we find a cellist who can play in tune? I don't know why we pick on the cellist, but that's just standard amongst string quartet players. In Baton Rouge, they had said they had had somebody. I was born in Baton Rouge. And then in Ithaca, where we had childhood, they had somebody else. And then in Richmond, they went through a couple of cellists and a violist. But mother and daddy were always first and second chair.
And I gather you did not, since you were a pianist. Did any of your siblings become string players enough to play with your parents?
No, they tried. And I was started on violin lessons, and I just couldn't do it. I swore my arm hurt, and my father said, well, then you're holding it wrong, because when you hold a violin correctly, it doesn't hurt. I assume there was too much tension there, and my arm continued to hurt. And then I loved playing the piano. I can't even read music anymore because that's been so long ago, but I really loved the piano, and I worked hard at it. But I just knew it was not really going to be my future. And when I announced to my parents that I was going to become a writer, my mother screamed and said, I'm going to get a butcher knife. She ran down the hall to get this butcher knife to come back and kill me so I wouldn't become a writer like my older brother wanted to be.
And a writer is worse than a string player. Why?
Oh, yes. Oh, well, because writers in that era were beatniks. And my brother was earning my brother was earning his living by playing chess in Washington Square Park in New York, and she just, you know, they wanted us to have more comfortable lives than they had had, but it just wasn't in the offing.
But they chose those uncomfortable lives.
They
you
did.
Say, so.
They did, and they loved it. But they nevertheless thought, if I had become a violinist, they would have been content. But they didn't really want us to be in the arts. So my sister started on the violin, and then she took ballet and had to quit because of a cyst growing on her leg. And then she started playing the flute in the school band. But she would come home after school every day and put on a radio channel that played a lot of country music and hillbilly music. And
well, there is money
Elvis
in that.
Elvis Presley. And my parents just thought, oh, Anne is going to be boy crazy, and she's got a boyfriend in the band, and we can forget about ever making her a musician. But in fact, all the time, Anne was seriously practicing the flute. And one day when she was in about 15 or 16, she came out to the kitchen and said, Daddy, I have an audition with William Kincaid, who was then the number one flutist in the world. And so you need to drive me up to Philadelphia. And everybody's jaw dropped. But they did, and then Kincaid just kept saying, I like what I hear. Daddy was standing outside the studio door with his ear next to it. And so that's how Anne became a musician. And when I announced I was going to be a writer, it took a long time for my parents to come around to that. But they did eventually. By the time I had published a novel and was working on another one, they became extremely helpful. My mother typed a novel manuscript for me. They were very supportive, finally.
So no more butcher knife.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
You've written several essays that are why I write.
Yeah.
As if you're sort of trying to explain to yourself why you did this strange thing of becoming a writer.
Yeah.
I wonder, just as a sample of your nonfiction, if you could read part of your Why I Write Now essay.
I'd be glad to. The human spirit survives and prevails in the written word, the well-written word. Literature is testimony and tribute. It upholds our world. When people have gone from the world, literature will still bear witness to the breadth and depth of humanity, of humanness. No, not bear witness to it. It will be the human spirit, extant, alive. Our books are us. They will be what we were. And if the books themselves are lost, burned, or buried in an avalanche, or on purpose to avoid warehouse storage costs, or overwhelmed by melting polar caps, if they are seized and destroyed as contraband, but there is, after all, a limit to how much a writer can worry. A writer craves a little fame, a few prizes, and more readers. But that is not why she writes. Her deepest concern is not for herself, here or hereafter. Her concern, her dream, is to make a thing that does not, cannot die. So what if it goes unread? Her dream is to create an object of beauty and power that gives to the human spirit a home in eternity. Her dream is to discover the shape and substance of the soul. That shape, that substance, that is the work of art.
Did any of your siblings, I realize they had other professions, but turn into writers then? Or is there something unique about you that makes you have this compulsion to write, given that you've come from the same soil that they have?
I don't think of it as a compulsion. I just think of it as a joy. My sister has now written a couple of books. She doesn't take her writing very seriously, but she published a murder mystery, and she wrote a book about musicians who have diseases, various diseases in later years. And I think she feels she's done with writing by now, but she has had just a natural talent for telling a very funny story. She's a very funny person. And a natural ability for narrative.
Now, somebody has said, and I don't remember who, and it's probably actually more than one person, but I read this again just recently, mm-hmm. that the best novelists, the best storytellers in this country come from the South, as of course you do. Is there a connection?
There used to be. It's less and less true, of course, as the South becomes more and more just like every other place in the nation. But, yes, Southerners, first of all, they had the Bible. And there was not a Southerner who didn't know the Bible, which with its beautiful rhetoric, and especially the King James Version, and all the stories therein. Those writers and myself, too, come from families who would sit on the porch in the evening and tell stories to one another. That was how you entertained yourself before there was television and
at a slower pace.
At a slower pace, yes. You always would string the stories out as long as you could. And the third thing was, of course, that for a lot of the South, the Civil War seemed like a defeat. And there was a nostalgia for the formerly old, leisurely pace. And, of course, as a friend of mine pointed out quickly, black Southerners think of the Civil War as a victory, not as a defeat. Mm-hmm. But there still was that strain, and the three together colluded to raise writers.
Well, there's nothing like a sense of loss to evoke a great story.
Yes, exactly.
We're going to take a look at some of the poetry of Virginia's poet laureate, Kelly Cherry, when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Quartet without beginning or end. Perhaps they play their violins in some place where the strings are never out of tune and never break. Haydn and Beethoven come and take seats. Never again the Jejun Debussy. From here on, for eternity, they'll play only the real stuff which survives. As they do on that south bank of the City of God, where music is the soul of that which lives forever, quartet without beginning or end. Musicians' lives go on inside the music, a shadow score, and though the melodies darkened by pain, transposed to the key of sorrow by sickness, it's brightened by the brilliance of violins, for there is music even in such silence.
That's the poem Quartet Without Beginning or End, read by Kelly Cherry. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and our guest is Kelly Cherry, currently the poet laureate of Virginia and a former faculty member from UW-Madison. When you turn to writing poetry, what do you find is the most joyful part of that genre? Because I know you also write fiction and nonfiction. When you turn to writing poetry, what is it that excites you most?
Actually, what excites me about each of the forms is the loss of time. When you're really wholly concentrating on anything, you escape time. And that's what I love about the act of writing. Poetry is a little more like solving a puzzle than fiction is. Fiction is a little bit more about complicating the puzzle. But in every case, what I really love is just forgetting the world. You forget the world while you're writing.
Now, when you write a novel, I think it's probably common for most novelists not really to have that clear an idea of where they're going. It's been described as driving in the fog, mm-hmm. With the headlights mm-hmm. dim at best mm-hmm. from the beginning till you get to the end. But with poetry, do you have a clearer idea where it's going to go emotionally or in terms of message?
It varies. I sometimes have an idea of what the sense of the poem is going to be, or the mood of the poem, or
the sound.
I'll decide I want it in rhyme or not rhyme, or certain meter or not meter. But even so, when you write a poem, you're looking to surprise yourself. And the surprises just come in the lines. The most important thing for a writer to be able to do is to read the page that he is writing. If you can read that page really carefully, and that's hard to do because you approach the page with all your preconceptions about it. But if you can really see the page clearly, the page will tell you where to go.
So, for example, if you go in with the idea, vague idea perhaps, that you're going to say ABC, mm-hmm. and the poem says ADF, mm-hmm. you have to be able to accept that and go with the flow and not try to squeeze your original message what's naturally flowing.
That's right. And you may find the original message will turn up in another poem. But you need to be guided by the page. This is, I think, easier to see when you're writing fiction because you have a sentence and it's either maybe introduced a character or you're in a certain kind of room and you can look at that sentence and say, oh, yeah, well, in that room there is this object or this person. And then the next sentence, that person's going to do something else, and that pulls you along. With poetry, you're a little less alert to the pull. There's more of a sense of push. The poem kind of, because it's so formal, I think it pushes you in certain directions. And I mean that word formal to apply to free verse as well as
to the structure.
Yeah.
I assume that since you are Virginia's poet laureate now, that they've forgiven you your Wisconsin years. claim you as their own.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. It was nice to have that happen because for a long time Virginia was completely oblivious of me as a writer. But now I'm beginning to feel like part of the Southern Writers Group again.
And what does Virginia expect from its poet laureate? I mean, you get into what's called occasional poetry, and they want you to write a poem about, a new railroad line or something. You say, well, I guess I can make myself do that, or how does it work?
Well, it varies. There are no requirements for the Virginia poet laureate. There's no pay and no reimbursement either.
So that's why the job was so hotly contested.
Yes, exactly.
Back to your parents' string quartet choice.
Right. But people, press release went out and people called me with various things they would like for me to do. The first thing I was asked to do was to judge a Christmas tree contest. So it doesn't necessarily pertain exactly to poetry. But I've since judged several poetry contests and I lead a reminiscence group at a local nursing home, assisted living home. And I've got other readings scheduled. People just call. One person has asked me to write a poem that he wants to put to music, and perhaps it will become a state song. But I've had trouble with that because my poems, the lines tend to run over. For example, they don't come to an end the way a marching song would. So we're trying. I don't know whether – he's very good. I'm not sure at all whether I can live up to that. But it's an interesting project.
I did notice that you have a section in your poetry collection, Hazard and Prospect, that's called Virginia. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could share one you wrote in that section called God's Picnic. And I think it's set in the Blue Ridge Mountains, if I remember right.
It's a tiny little poem, but I had fun writing it. Yes. God's Picnic, parenthesis, Blue Ridge, and that's where it's set. God takes a left off the Skyline Drive, parks at a scenic view, picks out a rock, unpacks a picnic. The valley is a hammock strung between mountains. He chews while gazing at the panorama. Later, he drives back to his motel, nearly empty off-season, enters his room to write a poem about the state of his creation. And, of course, that state of his creation is the state of Virginia as well as anything else.
So Virginia, by implication, is sort of God's gift to the Union.
Well, it thinks it is. It thinks it is. A famous newspaper man once said that of his state, North Carolina, that it was a valley of humility strung between two mountains of conceit, Virginia and South Carolina.
I like your image in that poem of the valley as a hammock strung between two mountains. That's really nice. Another poem that I was wondering if you could share is about, I think it's called Reading, Writing, and Hiding, or Reading, Hiding, and Dreaming.
Yeah. This poem was actually written after I had spent time in Latvia with a friend that I was trying, we were trying to get married, and the Soviet authorities wouldn't allow us to. And we stayed in this little cottage out a bit from the city of Riga in a room that had blue painted floors, ivy growing over the windows and over the house. It was a wonderful feeling. And in the driveway a few yards down were a couple of KGB agents.
Sounds very idyllic.
Keeping an eye on us, yeah. And the KGB agents were there, of course, to try to scare us. But in fact, it just made the room that much cozier and private, and it was a wonderful feeling. So this is a poem written about that room and about my friend at that time. And there's an epigraph from Czesław Miłosz. You asked me, what is the good of reading the Gospels in Greek? It comes from a poem of his called Readings, but it is absolutely impossible to know what that line means in his poem. It's such a mysterious line that I was drawn to it, and this poem arrived. Reading, dreaming, hiding. You were reading. I was dreaming the color blue. The wind was hiding in the trees, and rain was streaming down the window full of darkness. Rain was dreaming in the trees. You were full of darkness. The wind was streaming down the window, the color blue. I was reading and hiding. The wind was full of darkness and rain was streaming in the trees and down the window. The color blue was full of darkness, dreaming in the wind and trees. I was reading you.
That has a lot of the kind of repetition that you would find in a Sestina or something like that.
But it's not a Sestina. It's not a Villanelle. It's just using some repetition and variation.
Do you ever read things that people have written about your poetry and think, whoa, where'd they come up with that?
Yes, I did it not long ago. It was actually a very favorable review, but I didn't recognize my book in it. So that
take
happens.
What you can.
Yes, you do. You do.
Another poem that I think it's in your newer collection that I like. It's a little bit longer, but it seems to capture the way you have to search for kind of golden moments whenever you find them, and it's a poem you call Joy.
Yes, that's in the Virginia section, too. This is set on what used to be our front porch in Virginia, which we no longer have because my husband is in the process of tearing the house down and rebuilding it. Joy. You could be doing anything, arranging dahlias in a vase, sipping tea on a screened-in porch, or sticking stars on fourth-grade papers. But anything. You could be driving a truck, offloading supplies on foot patrol in Baghdad or halfway to Damascus. You might be having a baby, a break, or second thoughts, or words with your troublesome teenage son. You could be anywhere, at home, at work, or off on vacation. The flowers may remind you of 4th of July firecrackers. You may recall a day you spent learning to identify the ferns and mosses in Pocahontas Park, a windy day, warm and brilliant, rampant leaves spinning against the sky. Or if not that, a difficult meeting in which you gripped your water glass tight, feeling the cold enter your skin. There was the closing of a deal, a forklift on the dock, a medical emergency, a war, divorce, the isolation room, a glass vase of dahlias. You could have been anywhere. You could be there now. You could be anywhere walking through woods or sitting on a screened-in porch, writing a poem. And there you are, surprised by it.
You have gotten into this project now that is, in some ways it sounds very prosaic, the subject, in another way is mysterious and even dangerous, and that's this Robert J. Oppenheimer project. How in the world did you come up with that as an idea for not just a poem, but an extended poetic work?
I actually came up with it 35 years ago and simply never had the time to do the necessary research while I was teaching. But now I do have the time, and I've done a lot of the research. I first saw Oppenheimer's picture on the cover of The Open Mind, a book that my brother had given me for my birthday. And I fell in love with the book. It was just, it was nonfiction, but it kind of talked about philosophy, and that's what he told me it was. And then I knew I wanted to major in philosophy. But I also looked at the picture of Oppenheimer on the book jacket, and he had a striking face and incredibly beautiful eyes. And then, you know, it was the 50s. Oppenheimer was in the news. Einstein was in the news. The bomb was in the news. And so it was all around me, and it staggers me now to find that there are actually young scientists, even young physicists, who don't really know who Oppenheimer was, because he was just a major figure in my child youth. So I thought of this idea, but then had no time to pursue it. But in the past couple of years, I was fortunate enough to have a residency from the Rockefeller Foundation at Bellagio and another at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. And previously, I had made a trip to Los Alamos to talk with the archivists there. So I began to have material. Now the problem is how to make poems about the right pieces of material. And the problem is also is how to get rid of the feeling that it's material rather than poetry. And those are big problems, and I'm trying to solve them poem by poem. And I'm not there yet. I know that. But
And can you tell us your working title and the sort of scope of the project?
The working title is Quartet for J. Robert Oppenheimer. It's in four parts. It follows a chronological narrative. The first part, Vectors, takes him from youth to up to Los Alamos. Gadgetry, which Gadget was the name for the bomb at the time in Los Alamos. So Gadgetry is the title of the second section, and that's all about the building of the bomb. And then there's a section that so far I've not got a single poem for because I haven't figured out how to do it. That's titled Kangaroo, and it's about the hearings.
The McCarthy hearings.
Where he was stripped of his security clearance. Oppenheimer was stripped. And then the last section is called Actual Philosophy. I think it's Max Born who said that theoretical physics is actual philosophy. And I always loved that line. I may have the wrong author, but I think it's Max Born. And so that's the last section.
Well, that would be an ambitious project to take that concept and put it into poetry, because
right.
You have to know physics and you have to know, of course, philosophy and poetry.
Well, I did study philosophy in graduate school, and I had physics and some other sciences in college, which you know, I'm the farthest thing in the world from a physicist, and I don't know how to change a light bulb. But nevertheless, I got through classes in them, and I've always been fascinated by scientists. They're interesting people, and they're usually very smart people.
Oppenheimer, even more interesting than some,
yes.
I would say. A very complicated man,
yes.
And he did become deeply interested in philosophy and religion, learned how to read Sanskrit.
Absolutely.
Bhagavad Gita was one of his major influences.
This is his favorite poem.
You have to delve into that, too, then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I'm doing what I can. I'm not learning Sanskrit.
There is a limit. And do you see it as a kind of epic poem?
I do. And that's a problem because books can't do, most publishers cannot do very long books of poems. Most publishers, independent publishers, university presses can't do very long books, period. If I can keep this under 120 pages, my regular publisher will do it. If I can't, I'll have to find some other solution. So it just remains to be seen. It's a minimum of 2 years before I'll finish. And that's assuming inspiration strikes when necessary. And you can't always count on that. And then there's often, with the smaller presses, there's a long lag time between acceptance and publication. But I'm having enormous fun with it.
Well, and so there's this combination of the poetic and inevitably the practical.
Yeah.
And as you're working on this subject, how are you dealing with sort of, I guess, the victims of the bomb or of the situation?
Well, as I mentioned, the poem deals with Oppenheimer's times, not just his life, because I want us to be able to see him in context. I have a couple of poems about the Holocaust. I think right now I have three of them. I've tried writing a poem about Hiroshima, and it's no good.
It's a tough assignment.
Yes. And Carolyn Forché wrote two wonderful poems about Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And Ron Wallace wrote a wonderful poem about the subject, too. So, and I know mine just is not at that level yet, so I'm not sure whether that will appear or if inspiration will strike. But, then there are references to some of the poets Oppenheimer loved, or he was concerned and contributed money to the Spanish Civil War. So there's a poem about Guernica. And there's a poem about Shostakovich, so forth.
he obviously was very much a man of his times, although he could be very insular in some ways. He was very much moved through his times. I mean, he indirectly was affected by the Spanish Civil War, certainly by World War II, certainly by the McCarthy hearings.
Yeah. He's a remarkably central figure, and if the fact that they stripped him of his clearance had a lot to do with the development of the American empire, because there would have been no hydrogen bomb if it had been left up to Oppenheimer. But the military-industrial complex was determined that that would happen, and that was one of the real reasons they wanted him out. But he was at the center of all this stuff. And part of the problem, too, is, you have to pick and choose your moments and not just try to go everywhere at the same time.
Sure, sure. But, I mean, you can certainly get a flavor of the times that he lived in. And I would gather with just not too many details a sense of, I wouldn't say eccentric, but what an individual he was.
Oh, he was very individual and very unusual and really quite a polymath. I'm also including a handful of translations from the Aeneid, some from the Iliad, so that without stating it, I can kind of suggest that Oppenheimer was, in his own right, a war hero by managing all those people at Los Alamos and elsewhere, too. Most of them are kind of short translations, but they'll be in there, and I hope that they help to unify the book.
Well, we'll have to, when you have that out in a couple of years, have to have you back to talk specifically about that project. Meanwhile, we're going to talk to you when we return in a moment about your fiction. Back in a moment with University of the Year.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Kelly Cherry, who, in addition to being the poet laureate for the state of Virginia, also writes nonfiction and prose fiction. And do you ever sort of drift from one genre to the other when you come up with an idea, Kelly? You think, oh, what a great poem, and then suddenly it turns into a little novel?
That used to happen occasionally. I once wrote a poem and then realized it needed to be a short story. But it happens much less often now because I can tell from the rhythm of whatever line I have in my head or whatever idea I have in my head, the shape of the idea, I can usually tell what it needs to be.
And what triggers a novel?
Oh, a novel, well, actually someone was just mentioning the other day that women don't start novels with situations. They start with relationships. But in fact, I've always started my novels, which do tend to be about relationships, as all novels do, I think. Nevertheless, I've always started them with some kind of situation. And then, and I don't know where I'm going, but a situation has developed and the people in it have to deal with that situation.
I really like the opening of your novel and story. It's called My Life and Dr. Joyce Brothers, where you have your main character on a plane with a rather humorous steward and thoughts of, or I guess doubts as to whether she even should be on the plane,
right,
heading toward, I guess, a relationship. Can you read the opening?
This book, My Life and Dr. Joyce Brothers, is set in Madison and is the first of what will be a story cycle running through three volumes. The second one has been published, and I'm at work on the third one. And the central character in the book, though not always the central character in the stories, is Nina Bryant. This story is called Flying Through Weather. The steward is a stand-up comic. If you are on the wrong flight, he says, as they shut the door, now would be an excellent time to deplane. I like his joke, but wonder if I should deplane. I'm still wondering when the plane lifts off. We are flying over houses the size of Monopoly tokens. We are passing go. The steward has a light laugh that sweetens his sarcasm, making it palatable. If there is anything else we can do to make your trip more pleasant, he says at the end of his speech, keep it to yourself. This draws a round of applause. We settle back, seat belts fastened. Sunlight makes everything seem overeager, too sharp, too ready for exposure. The seat back in front of me is shedding hairs like some kind of shaggy synthetic dog. I wonder if I'm making a fool of myself. Over a man, of course, men being what women who make fools of themselves make fools of themselves over. For example, I keep my feet on the ground, except when hurtling through space at an altitude of 35,000 feet toward a man who to date has declined to make a commitment. I wonder if he is thinking of me. Probably not. He shouldn't be. He is out here on business. I have one of these free, frequent flyer tickets and am joining him for the weekend. Until I get there, he is supposed to be persuading a group of faceless, to me, men, of the fiscal soundness of their investment in his arcane, to me, research. DNA. He does something with DNA. What this something is, I have often tried to understand. Slowly, with a deep luxuriousness, it begins to manifest itself to me. Meanwhile, I concentrate on data more likely to yield to my analysis. He is my age. He is getting divorced. His children are in the 7th and 8th grades, respectively. Does a man ever marry a woman his own age? I ask myself in the spirit of scientific and not-so-scientific inquiry. Does a man ever marry the woman he meets while his divorce is still in progress? And the children? When I think of children, of which I have none, my heart starts to race frantically, as if blinded by a maze it cannot find its way out of. My heart is a slow learner.
Do you ever read your books aloud while you're working on them?
Yes.
So you're writing for the ear?
Well, both, for the page and for the ear. I also do all my writing by longhand first, because I think computers force us to write too quickly. I need to hear it. I need to have it sink in. I need to think about what it actually says. And that takes time, and it's about the right amount of time for me to do some handwriting. And, yes, I do read the fiction out loud as well as the – you know, the fiction has its own music based on the sentence. And
as opposed to the line.
Right.
Well, a
novel is based on the scene. But the novel and stories, of course – has an overarching narrative arc, but it breaks down into short stories, and that means the sentence is very important.
I saw in an interview you talked about some funny instances where people assumed that the stories were all autobiographical and mm-hmm. made comments to you, oh, I'm sorry about your brother, I'm this or that. And mm-hmm. Can you talk about the sort of the challenge of taking things from your life, putting it into fiction in different forms, but then having people assume it's all about you?
Well, a very sophisticated and well-known writer once heard me read a story about Nina and a little girl and came up to me afterwards and said, "What do you do? Where do you put your little girl when you come here to give readings?" And I had to say, "Well, the little girl is imaginary. She's still in my head." It happens. It's just natural.
It's probably
a compliment, right? I think it is, yes. The more successful the fiction is, the more it will read like it's nonfiction, because you want to be creating for your reader a world. And especially with long fiction, you want it to be a world that the reader can actually live in for a period of time.
Do you worry about hurting the feelings of living people?
Well, when I've put living people, and I do have put a few in who know they're in the stories, they're lovely people. There's nothing ill to say about them. And then a lot of my people are made up, and readers simply don't always realize that.
Do you ever discover, after having written a book, that, oh, now I know where that character came from?
I think that has happened to me once or twice. Not where the whole character would come from, but some feature of the character, you know, has sort of subliminally impressed itself on my brain. Yeah.
Do you want to close with a little bit more from your collection?
Okay. I mentioned that Nina at some point acquires a child, and this is from a story, the opening of a story called Space Baby. "There's just no stopping this kid," I said to her. "Mommy's sleeping. Be quiet." I pulled the blinds against the bright winter sun. I lay down on the bed, shut my eyes. I wanted to be carried away to a far-off world where dreams had time to ripen, like pears in an orchard, where they had time to develop like pictures in a dark room. Next thing, she was in my study. I heard her making snowballs out of my expensive 20-weight white typing paper. "Get out of there at once," I shouted. "Oh, no," she said. "Mommy's asleep." I made her sit in the corner.
It's been a pleasure having you here.
Thank you so much for having me, Emily.
Our guest has been Kelly Cherry. I'm Emily Auerbach. I hope you can join Norman Gilliland and me for the next hour of University of the Air.